Oh, thank you very much. Very sweet. It's really, really lovely to be here, and I am always happy to do anything for my friend Joel. He's a fabulous man and teacher and prankster. So he maybe pulled another prank of saying yes to you when he ended up being in Rwanda and managing to slip me in here so that we could get to know each other. So thank you, Joel. Safe travels back. He's flying as we speak, and I'll be looking forward to getting all the stories of his amazing adventure in Rwanda. So we've got Thanksgiving coming up this next week, and it seemed to me an appropriate and timely sort of thing to maybe tie together the national practice of eating thankfully with the daily Jewish practice of eating thankfully. To kind of get warmed up a little bit, okay, so just here's the deal. From a Jewish point of view, knowing nothing is kind of the highest of the high. Because it means you get to learn. And learning is, you know, that's what it's all about. We're here to learn. So do not be shy if I ask a question. These are not shaming questions. These are not to assert that I'm the authority and you know nothing. What this is to do is to just figure out, like, what we've got in the room and where we can kind of slither to bring in some new thoughts and maybe some new information. So, how many of you feel like you are completely down with the Old Testament? Like, you know it. If I ask you questions about it, you will go, oh, yeah, I know who that guy is. Right? Who feels solid? Okay, great. We got one. Excellent. All right? Because that means the rest not. We are going to have some gaps to fill in, so that's great. All right? Can anybody, does anybody think about what's your first understanding in the Old Testament of where food fits in? Anybody, where's your first recollection in the Torah, chronologically, as you're reading through the text? Where's the first thing that you notice something about food? Yeah. Garden of Eden, right? So for those of you for whom this is brand new information, the Torah, the Old Testament, Genesis, the first book, begins in a garden. Or it actually begins in chaos, which is where everything begins. Right? It begins in chaos, and as chaos starts to get oriented through the machinations of the great creator, things start to get ordered and organized, and human beings find themselves at the beginning of chapter 2, after all of this organization has taken place, in a place called Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. Okay, yes?
Yes, can you speak to the microphone?
Yes. Okay, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, you're recording? Are you crazy? I'm going to be running around this room. You should have strapped me to the thing. All right, so the Garden of Eden is where humanity turns up. Actually, humanity turns up before that in the mire, in the coming together, in the organizational process. The end of chapter 1 is when all that organization takes place. Chapter 2 begins with a completely different tone in the world, sort of, maybe, kind of, as we know it. And humanity is living in a place called the Garden of Eden, in which we are told, you got everything you need here. You just have to take care of it, that's all. But where does food fit in? What's the food situation? All right? There's plenty. The great creator says, you can eat any of the seed-bearing plants that are in this place. All of y'all, the lions, the tigers, the bears, and the humans, y'all eat seed-bearing plants. You can eat fruit, anything that's got a seed, you can eat it. So we're all vegetarians at that point. Bahoots, outside of, except for that tree right in the middle of the garden, the one with the really pretty fruit in it that smells really good that you can't really escape because it's so yummy and delicious and excellent, that one right in the middle of the garden that you have to walk past every day, that I'm putting my serpent friend, the Nahash, the trickster, wrapped around the trunk to make sure that you don't eat from that tree. Don't eat from that tree, whatever you do. If you ever put, like, a plate of warm cookies in the middle of a room with a bunch of kids and tell them, don't eat those, that's what happens in the Garden of Eden. So the very, very first real temptation, real excitement, real, like, a waking up comes through this thing that we are not supposed to do. So, of course, what do? We can't resist it. And even if we could, the Nahash is wrapped around that tree going, oh, come on. He told you that? Oh, man, I've heard that a million times. No, I've been around. I'm like, I know this show. You can eat from it. Really, come on, try it. You're going to love it. And what happens when we eat from it? Anybody remember the name of that tree? Yes. Okay, great. You're going to write that one down.
You need this to be a conscious member of the human race. We eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Okay? That's the fruit that we eat. It is not an apple.
It is something quite a bit more amazing than an apple. It is the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. All right, take a second, look at that, and talk with your neighbor. I give you literally a minute and a half to see which is the most important word on that of that. What's the most important word? Talk with your neighbor. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. What's the most important word? All right, 10 seconds. What's that? What's the most important word? All right, raise your hands. Be good citizens. Raise your hands and we'll just go around. What's the most important word? Go ahead, raise your hands. Okay, we got knowledge. Knowledge. How many for knowledge? Okay. All right, how tree. All right, we got tree. Anybody else? Anybody other than knowledge or tree? Good and evil, that's three words. Evil, okay. Evil, we got two for evil. Any, what else? Anybody a dissenting opinion? Okay, the whole sentence, but I'm looking for one word, but we'll go with that possibility. All right, so when we eat from this thing, we gain knowledge. Did we have knowledge before? Well, the human has to name everything in the garden. So we maybe had some cognizance or some ability to think and know. We had to know something in order to name the creature. So just you should know, if you haven't read it, it's really worth a read. Those two chapters, very short, very packed. So maybe what we gain is knowledge. But look very carefully at how the sentence is constructed, which is pretty close to the biblical Hebrew. I'd say that we don't need to work too hard on analyzing the surface meaning of the text, though we could. So what about tree? Why tree? Why is tree important? The tree people? Who are the tree people?
It's rooted in the earth.
Mm.
It's part of creation.
Ooh.
So when you do something with it, you're a creator too, so you're partaking of the
Godhead. Okay, great. But we ate from other trees too, which would also be true. Okay. But why in this sentence is that word most important, given that this is the one that we're forbidden? Because we're not forbidden from all tree fruit, just this tree. But I like that. Okay. Ooh, it's an avatar. All right. It's a stand-in for something else. Nice. Okay, now we're interpreting good. Okay. There is definitely a Kabbalistic, a Jewish mystical component here, which says that the root of all
evil,
of all, the root of all comes up into the material existence, and that the root of the tree then taps down into that, and then the root of our soul taps into the tree, and there's like a connection, like a series, a chain, that the deeper it goes, and that the metaphor of going deep down into the earth, into that mystery place, into that which we cannot see, and that's hard to understand. How could it be that those little hair-like roots are able to support this gigantic being is part of it. Okay, good. What else?
And the tree before the fruit happens, it is also already vital. So it's already.
Yes. Okay, so this has already got a vitality that we're going to pull from. But this one we're forbidden. This particular one, the tree, not just trees, not, you can't eat from trees. You can't eat from this tree. This tree is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So it. Ooh, that's where I'm going. I think the word here, this is the most important word. That at this tree is the tree that gives us the ability, the knowledge, to see bifurcation, to see in duality. We see duality with good and evil. Before we eat, if we don't eat from this tree, we see no duality. Can I use this? Oh, there you go. All right. Now I feel like Phil Donahue. All right. So this tree changes our perception of what we experience from equanimity, from it's all good, from it's all real, from it's all what it is, and acceptance, and just being in it and not judging it. This is actually a cagey way of saying you're eating from the tree of judgment. And how do we get there? Through eating. We eat it. Eating is the first act that makes us distinctively human. It's eating. Before that, we're kicking it like the squirrels. You know, you don't see squirrels protesting. You don't see them walking around with pickets and signs and saying, this is wrong, right? They exist and they accept and they flow and they fight when they have to fight. And they don't, you know, it's like, yeah, I could fight with you yesterday and I'm like, you know, eating the acorns next to you tomorrow. Or just like, hey, this is my territory, don't come in. It's pretty straightforward. It's not personal. It doesn't really appear to be a broken state of duality. Most other creatures seem to flow with what is without wanting to mess it up too bad. You know, a little nest. They need to make a nest. It's like the beavers, okay, they can create dams that can kind of create a different flow of energy in the waterways a little bit. But, you know, the water's pretty strong and seems to be a pretty equal exchange. Humanity is the one that comes along and says, we're going to do this our way. We're going to break it up. Like, we know what's right and wrong. We know what's good and bad. We're going to, like, make all of these, you know, changes. And then other people are going to come back and, you know, I mean, look at us. No other creature has impacted the world the way that we have. That knowledge, quote unquote, that da'at is the word in Hebrew. right? It's knowledge is the same word as sexual knowledge. Same word. There's no distinction between the intellect and the primal urges of creativity in Judaism. That the primal urges of creativity are you eat from this tree and now your creativity is going to see in technicolor. It's not going to be black and white anymore. So you eat from this, wow, man, everything's going to start popping, but you're going to be in Oz, not Kansas. Right? Kansas, black and white. Oz, technicolor. So, and the methodology in Judaism is eating. And that metaphor, that beginning place of the experience of ingestion, of nutrition, of pleasure, of gastronomic pleasure, this is the source. This is the first text. And then it goes on, and as you read other stories, you will notice if you're reading through Abraham. So Abraham comes along, food plays in big in all of his wheelings and dealings. Right? He is first greeted by this great king, Melchizedek, who is like, whoa, you're the man. Please come and I want to meet you. So he greets him with a feast, with particularly bread and wine. Right? Because bread and wine end up being these really metaphoric, important foods in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam, in a very different way. In Islam, we got rid of the wine. We're going to take the wine out of the quotient and really focus on the bread. So it pops up again and again and again. Abraham and Sarah, they figure this out. They learn this social technique. Now when they meet strangers, they roll out a beautiful feast and they entertain basically using food. Then we start to see food as this agent of human transformation. When you start looking at the way that food pops up in the Torah, especially in Genesis, you see a lot of moments that are seminal moments, that are important moments, that are transformative moments, and food is going to play a major role. And then we get it playing on the good and evil things. So we get things like the two brothers, Jacob and Esau. Twins. Now, I don't know about you, but in my generation, twins are often seen as like the paradigmatic people who understand each other on a cosmic level. Whether they're fraternal twins or identical twins, there is this at least mythology, if not reality, that twins are dialed up to each other, that they are connected in a way that is unique. There are all these twins organizations. I've had to work with many, many sets of twins where one died and the other one is just bereft and feels so off balance because their twin passed away and they don't quite know, they don't have another connection point that is the same as they had with their twins. But in the Torah, we get these twins who are battling from the get-go. It's completely counterintuitive. It flies in the face of everything that we think or we know, we know about twinning. But these two are a metaphor. They are the polar opposite oneness. They're the way that oneness can be broken into and. So it's Jacob and Esau, the twins. It's a paradox. And they are fighting from conception all the way out into the world. They're polar opposites. One is kind of like, he likes to cook and hang out in the tents. He's his mother's favorite. The other one's kind of, big burly, let me go kill something kind of guy. And he's his father's favorite. So you get this bifurcation. You get and all the way through that story. This and that, the mother and the father, this energy and that energy. It's just this complete story of polarity. And there's a moment where transference starts to happen, where a transformation starts to happen, where the one steps into the other's territory and they start to exhibit a kind of transformative moment. And it happens through food. Jacob's cooking a pot of stew. His brother comes in tired and hungry from a day of hunting and says, "Give me some of that stew." And Jacob says, okay, but you got to give me your birthright. And Esau says, "I'm dying of hunger. What good is my birthright?" "Yeah, sure, you can have the birthright. Whatever. Just give me some stew." It's through food. It's through the desire to eat. It's through the one creating the food and the other ingesting the food. This is a powerful metaphor. And again, so that transformation starts to happen. And again, in their story, at the end of their the tension between them, it also happens through food. So the father, Isaac, is supposedly dying. Of course, he doesn't die for another 25 years. Such an old Jewish guy. Oh, I'm dying. Oh, I can't take it anymore. Hey, 20 years later, I'm still dying. Oh, Gavalt. So we get Isaac, you know, claiming to be on his last legs. And so the blessings have to happen. You have to bless your sons in the proper order in order for you to die and you know, leave your heirs knowing who's who and who's going to now run the family and who's going to maintain, you know, control over the purse strings. Well, Jacob has already gotten his hands on the purse strings, but now what remains is who's going to be the top dog. And he needs to get that firstborn's blessing. But he wasn't the firstborn. He was the secondborn. So he's reversing the order of things. He's creating a transformation in social order. And so he, Rebecca hears him, the wife, who loves him. It's one of the only real love stories in the entire Torah. And she is going to deceive and betray her husband for her son's sake, for her privileged son's sake, her favorite son's sake. So, how are they going to do it? What? Yeah, right? We know this family, right? Some of us have come from this family, right? Some of us are building this family. It's human. It's absolutely the human story, right? So she's going to, you know, pull this scam. And how are they going to do it? Dad says, hey, I'm getting ready to make my blessings on you guys. He says to Esau, who should be the top dog, who's supposed to be the one who gets the primary blessing, go catch me some of that game and prepare it the way you know I love it, and so I can bless you. Once again, it's through food. Food plays a major, major role, which starts to explain, and there's countless other stories of this. It just goes on and on. It starts to explain the ways in which it has trickled down into Judaism, where we are well known for our obsessive behavior around food. I mean, how many Jewish rituals have I done? I've done a lot, hundreds and hundreds of bar mitzvahs and weddings and funerals and all of it. And I can tell you that culturally, the poor bartenders are standing over there going, would anybody like some free alcohol? Anyone? Anyone in this room? Free alcohol? Anyone? I have a half a glass of wine, thank you. The food table, man, they're over there like, okay, get some more food out here. Food table's being decimated. Absolutely decimated. And the bar is virtually empty. I worked with a wedding planner a couple of years ago. I was working with this Jewish couple. And this was the first Jewish wedding this Italian Catholic wedding planner had ever done. And she looked at their list and she goes, you need more alcohol. And they were like, no, we really don't. We really, really don't. No, we don't. But we probably could use another crate of, you know, something. She couldn't believe it. She could not believe it. And we all had to convince her, like, no, really, you know, a case of wine for 200 people is going to be enough. It's absolutely going to be enough. Don't worry about it. In fact, you'll be able to give your crew a couple of bottles to take home. Not to worry. This is something that has just filtered down and down and down. And it's primal. We all know that eating is a primal thing. It's a transformative thing. It literally is transforming your body. What you put inside your body is literally rebuilding yourself, right? And there's a way in which that has been internalized, excuse the pun, in Judaism in a really, really profound way. We get food then later as a manifestation of spiritual transformation as well. So all the stuff we talked about so far, it's like human. It's this very human stuff. But then we get this promise of how food is going to be in the world to come. When we're back in the Garden of Eden, if we ever manage to find our way back, when we finally have like had enough of and, when we've eaten so much and we can't stand it anymore, and we're completely glutted on it, and we're done with it, and the thrill is, we're done with the thrill. We're done with the thrill of that kind of diversity, right? When we are like, now we are hungry for and we are ready for equanimity, we're ready for all, for oneness, when we finally get there, what's the food going to be? Of course, this is a big question in the Jewish mind. Yeah, but what are we going to eat, you know? If we don't have and, what the heck is going to happen, you know? So we get manna. We get manna, which is echad, oneness. It's oneness. It comes down. It appears as one thing. It requires no earth, right? It takes us away from the earth. It comes where? From heaven. It grows from heaven, not from earth. It is a direct connection, not through all of these multiple layers, but it is direct. It requires no tending. It requires virtually no work, right? All you have to do is, you know, if you consider work just scooping and shoveling, then it requires tiny little little bit of work, right? But basically it requires no work, and it comes on its own, and it departs on its own. And not only that, but you cannot hoard it. You must not hoard it. If you hoard it, it rots. Other than that, it's a free gift, right? That's it. No hoarding, no preserving, no socking it away for tomorrow. There, it will be there tomorrow. It is that place of echad, oneness, of total faith and total belief, and that food is going to be provided, and we are not going to have to struggle and strive or compete. No competition. Wow. No competition. No having to wait and put things away for bad times, because it's always going to be there. Can you imagine thinking that way? How many of us think that way? How many of us could imagine that our entire kitchen would be, a stand no bigger than this. This would be our kitchen. That's it. That's your kitchen. No stove, no refrigerator, no cupboards. All you need is one plate, maybe a spoon. And that would taste like whatever you needed it or wanted it to taste like. I think my cats are the closest to this of any creature I've ever met. Because we feed them the exact same food. For our older guy, for 12 years, he has eaten the exact same meal every single day of his life. Every day. And you know what? He still is like, manna from heaven. I love it when this happens. Ah! And he attacks it and he loves it. He never complains. He's never like, oh, come on, this thing again. No, he's already there. He's in that echad place. He's in that oneness place. It's beautiful. I'm not. I eat the same thing 3 days in a row and I'm like ready to kill myself, right? It's horrible. So food is presented to us during that period of time when we're wandering in the desert as this promise of the future. What do? We complain. The Hebrews complain bitterly about it. What do they say? Anybody remember from Exodus? They're out there in the desert. Oh, manna again. And what do they say? Anybody remember? The food was better in Egypt. Spoken like true human beings. The food was better in Egypt. In Egypt, we had onions. It was tasty. We had fish. In Egypt, the food was better. Dude, you were enslaved. You had absolutely no control over your own destiny or your life. You were being beaten. You were being worked to death. And all you can think about is that food was tastier, and it probably wasn't even. Are you out of your mind? Yes. That's what it means to be human, because we're struggling with and, this or that. Food next makes its big appearance as the form of offering. So when the temple is built, it is the connection to God is through food. We tend to talk about the sacrifices, the animal sacrifices. What did we do with the sacrifices? We ate them, right? So it's not, it's yes, it's about the transference of the wealth of the few into the sustenance of the many. On one hand, it is about that, giving up that which you have in excess and creating some kind of equality or at least some sharing that happens that brings everybody together to participate in that moment. Yes, there's that. But at the end of the day, all of the neuroses around the eating of it. The preparation of it and the giving of it is only the warm-up to the eating of it. So eating ends up being this communal act of connection to each other and to the one. It's all done through food. It's all done through eating. So I think I've made a pretty strong case for why the Jewish way of eating is very, very important. It's when you, the rabbis, so when so they build the temple and they eat for hundreds of years collectively, and that's their way of connecting to God. Eat, 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 right? And think about eating when we're not eating. Figure out what you have to bring. You're like, oh, this year wasn't so good. You know, I had a blight in my crops, and I had like some icky disease with my cattle, and they all died, and now I don't have anything to bring. Ah, it's okay, just bring some flour, right? Or bring what you can. There's always this out, which is bring what you can. But if you've got it to bring, bring the best. Always bring the best. If you don't have anything that's so, so great, just bring something, right? That's the essence of the practice, because it is the bringing and the sharing and the consuming that allows us to connect both horizontally with each other and vertically with the source. So we get that. Ugh. 70 Common Era. The temple is finally wiped out for the last time so far. Now what do we do? Well, we grew rabbis. That's what we did. When the first temple broke down with the Babylonians back in 586 before Common Era. 586, am I right? 586 before Common Era. There's no temple for about 50 years before the second temple has been reinstated. So in that 50-year period of no temple, we had no practice. Because you had to practice in the temple. You had to eat that sacred way of eating, that holy way of eating, could only happen in the temple. The rest is just sustenance. The rest is just, you know, nutrition. Individual. It's about the individual. It's about keeping you and your family alive. The other in the temple is about keeping the people alive, and it is about elevating that act. But for 50 years, it's not there. It's not a possibility. So what happens? The rabbis are born. The priests are out of a job, literally out of a job. They have nothing to do. They can't do their job. But we need something to hold the community together, or it was going to like blow away in the wind. And that is when what we now would refer to as the rabbis, the sages, the thinkers, the innovators, the creative force in Judaism, the intellectual force in Judaism, and a much more democratic force. You weren't born a rabbi. You were born a priest. You weren't born a rabbi. You had to become a rabbi. You had to prove yourself a rabbi, a teacher, a great one. Literally, the word means my great one. You had to elevate yourself. And so the rabbis are looking at this issue and they're really concerned about it. Like eating, 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 it's super important. We have to address this because this was how we connected before. And if we never rebuild the temple, which they had no assurance of doing in that time period, what are we going to do, right, to preserve this practice? And they come up with this beautiful... they look at the Torah, and there's a proof text that they refer to. And the proof text is in Deuteronomy, so towards the end of the five books. It says, V'achalta v'savata uvarachta. You shall eat, V'achalta, you shall eat, v'savata, and you shall be satisfied. Now, that appears elsewhere. That you shall eat and you shall be satisfied is kind of a no-brainer, right? I mean, it's a major... important issue for being alive. But then there's this one verse that adds in uvarachta, and you shall bless, and you shall bless. And the rabbis go back to that line and go, that's it. That was the hint. That was the wink, wink, nod, nod that God was giving us about what to do when the temple fell. We will bless. So we sacrificed before. Korban is the name of the sacrifice. Literally, it means to draw close. The korban was a drawing closeness exercise. And or olah, which is a going up. So there was definitely consciousness around what that food was doing. But here we get a whole new skew. You shall eat, because you have to, because you're an animal. And you shall be satisfied, because your body is designed to have an on and off switch. And you shall bless. That's not built in. That's a choice. That's a practice. That's consciousness. So they start looking at blessing as the way to turn your family dinner table into the altar. That's what they were all about. We have to transform the altar into something. Ah, v'achalt v'savata uvarachta. You shall eat and you shall be satisfied and you shall bless dinner. So the family dinner table becomes the altar, becomes the place where you connect and where you bring God, spirit, spirituality, the divine, the mystery into your daily action. It's an amazing little two-sentence moment in the Talmud. And they say, so now, okay, great. And they all go, ah, yes. But what about, because that's what rabbis do. But what about this? But what about that? Well, should we do it in the morning? In the morning? Only at dinner? I don't know. What if you're not at the dinner table? What if you're out in the world? What if you're standing at a falafel stand? Do you bless at the falafel stand? I don't know. Is it good falafel? I don't know. Let's try it. Well, should you bless before? What if it's really bad? Like, what if it's a really horrible piece of food? And you just blessed it. Now you have to eat the whole thing. Ah, maybe you should taste it first. I don't know. That's what ends up ensuing. But the essence, like the essential, the ikar, the essential pieces that get conveyed, get said like this. In Brachot, there's an entire tractate of the Talmud that's about blessings. By the way, what blessings are in the Torah itself? Correct. There's like one, right? The blessings in the Torah, they're not really so much there. There is the priestly benediction you're all probably familiar with. May the Lord protect you. May the Lord guide you and protect you. May the Lord's countenance shineth upon thee and radiateth from thee. And shall thy feet take thy to the place of peace. Right? Something to that weird effect. There's that. That's a blessing. Right? May God bless you and keep you. It's hard to translate. It has to do with light shining in and through you. And may its countenance, may you be faced with light and may it reflect through and on you. May everything in your life bring you to peace. Basically, is may you turn towards that which is whole and peaceful. That's a blessing. There's not this. So you guys have all, or at least every so often seats, you've got this sheet right here, which takes the standard blessing formula that the rabbis invented. And this is not language that we really find in the Torah. This is language that the rabbis created. And they created it because they said that we need to acknowledge the source of everything, because everything's a gift. Because everything is here, then all we really have to do is take it. And if we just take it and not acknowledge its source, it's like robbery. It's like violence. Yes. Got it. So the blessing formula you may have heard. If you've watched Seinfeld, you've heard this because right? This is the pot boiler. This is the one that I work with a lot of Jews who have like probably less Jewish education than everybody in this room. And they're scared of it because they don't know it. So they've got shame on top of everything else because they think they should know it. The one thing that I can kind of count on most people having had rammed down their throats at one point or another is this. Because this is the blessing over wine, and wine sets time apart. Wine is the conduit through which, the thing which we ingest, which helps us step into a unique moment, a unique relationship. It's what we use to kiddush, to make holy. But in Judaism, the idea for holiness is not that it's elevated. It's not, you know, I could say like, oh, this box of matches is used for lighting this beautiful light and only for that purpose. Then I've just made these holy. Because I've just set them aside from all other boxes of matches. There's nothing inherently better about this box of matches than any other, except that I have said, I am not using this for any other purpose, and therefore it kind of attains a certain unique quality in the world. So that's what Kiddush is. That's why when we drink that wine and make this blessing, we are saying this moment we are consciously setting aside from every other moment so that we can open up to it. And the whole idea of gratitude in Judaism is that feeling of opening up to the moment, of really letting it in and stepping away from the and stepping into the all. That's what that gratitude is. It's an acceptance of the whole totality of all the forces, all the elements that have come together to create this oneness that we are now going to participate in and bring us a little bit closer to that oneness. So, we never bless wine. If you look at these words, right? Baruch, blessed are atah, you. What are we blessing? You, the other. Whatever it is, it's not me. It's not, it doesn't say blessed is the wine. It never mentions wine. Blessed are you. Adonai. Adonai is a hard word to, and it's actually not Adonai. It's in the Hebrew, it's a word that is unpronounceable. It's the unpronounceable name of God. We substitute in Adonai, which is like one of the most earthly, my Lord. And I, like, literally they meant like the landlord. It's like a joke. You know, it's like the big man. Blessed are you, landlord of the universe. Right? Baruch, blessed, atah, are you, Adonai, that which we cannot even fathom, but which we feel is lording Eloheinu, our powers. Melech, ruler, king, counselor, sovereign, ha'olam, of time and space, of all time and space, of the universe, of eternity, of this world. Bore, the creator, the hollower, the shaper of Peri, the fruit of Hagafen, the vine. No mention of grapes, no mention of wine. This is the blessing for wine and only for wine or grape juice. You bless grapes differently. You bless other beverages differently. There are basically six distinct food blessings that there are actually blessing bees in the ultra-Orthodox world, in the Hasidic world. There are blessing bees where they put weird foods in front of these kids and say, what blessing and why? They have to argue why they would use that blessing. It's a whole other neurotic, beautiful universe. But this one really, I think, captures the essence of Jewish blessings on food. Because it's talking about the essential qualities. It's talking in metaphor. It's talking in holistic kind of terms rather than talking in particular terms. So first of all, we get an I-thou, as Martin Buber referred to it, an I-thou relationship. I'm talking to you. I've got the chutzpah as a dumb, flawed, selfish human being. I've got the chutzpah to say, I bless you, creator of the universe. It's amazing. It takes the and right out of it because it says, there is no and here. I bless you by being me because you created me and because here I am. And I'm going to use my powers of discernment and love to bless you. And you have created not just this crazy universe that I'm a part of, but you've created the twisting, turning, determined vines that start out tender. Like, have you ever seen a grapevine? The tip is very tender, very soft and green. And it wiggles its way out and it goes, uh-oh, no problem. Uh-oh. No problem. Oh. Oh, that's nice in there, right? It finds its way, and once it's found its way, it stiffens. And it turns into wood, and it holds on for dear life. And its roots go down, 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 down until it finds water. And then it produces the sweetest, most tender, most simple little fruits. So simple. And perfect size. Very easy to eat, very sweet, very nice. But when you break it, when you crush it, when you force them to be one, and then you put them in the dark, and you let them combine with all of the weird elements in the universe, with yeast and with light and with air, it turns into this magnificently complicated, slightly dangerous, just a wee bit toxic component that then elevates our spirits and helps us feel the one. It's time for you to go and pray. Amen. Thank you all so much for being here.
We'll have question and answer period.
Okay. Really? Yes. You have time for question and answer?
Question and answer period is now. Anyone have questions?
One, two. Three.
Would you tell us a little bit about the origins, reasons why for kosher?
Oh, gosh. I thought we were talking about gratitude here today. Kashrut comes from the big rubric over all of the dietary laws in Judaism. The dietary laws start in the Torah. I think that it's safe to say that it's okay to just say they're irrational. It's like probably the best answer is they're irrational. Why is that the best answer? Because it's about a mindfulness, practice. It causes us to stop before we shove the food in our mouth and go, oh, what is this? Can I eat it? Should I eat it? Why am I eating it? Is it permitted? Is it not permitted? And I think just, you know, it forces us to be mindful before we eat. And it puts a big red flag around food saying, you know what? You don't get to eat everything. How about that? How about if it's okay for you to like go, you know what? I'm really maybe not ready to eat everything. Maybe this whole thing isn't just for me to consume. And maybe there are some things that I have to just leave for other people to consume. You know, so we get to the banquet table, we get to the smorgasbord, and it's like, you know what? I'm going to leave the shrimp and the pork meatballs for somebody else. And there's a way that it's actually a profound practice. The rules in the Torah are, you know, the simple rules are no shellfish, no pork, no creatures that do not have both cloven hooves and chew their cud. So no clawed animals. This mostly rules out all predators and all scavengers. And to not mix it. The way that it says it in the Torah is very odd. It says you shall not eat the flesh of the kid boiled in its mother's milk. Why do we not be able to eat a turkey cheeseburger? Because the rabbis said, you know what? Let's just make sure. Let's just put a fence around that. Let's just push it out. You know what? Maybe it's about not mixing the energy of the flesh and the energy of the nutrition. And there's a pretty common, you know, midrash that says that the mother's milk is about sustaining life. Meat is about having taken a life. Let's separate those. We need to separate those. Putting those together is like cognitive dissonance. It's spiritual dissonance. So let's separate it. So kashrut is like a whole, that's a whole big universe. But those are the entry points. Yeah.
When you think how every culture, every country is obsessed about their diet, their food, the family gluts and... Could you make a distinction a little more about the Jewish glut?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a long story, right? We can see that there are roots to that fascination and that maybe obsession in the Torah because food ends up being talked about excessively in the Torah. It's a lot. There's a lot about food, either food practices or the kosher rules, the dietary laws are reiterated a couple of times. There are moments where food is, you know, someone's downfall. There are moments when food is like the moment, you know, when the elders are up on Mount Sinai and they have a one-on-one encounter with God. God is standing, and it's like total Timothy Leary, psychedelic, acid trip kind of stuff, right? They see God, and they see its feet, and it's on this sapphire brick, and everybody's like, "Wow, awesome! Did you see it? I saw it. Did you see it? Yeah, I saw it. Whoa!" And they have this great moment. What do they do immediately after? They eat and drink. Right then and there, they eat and drink. What happens when Joseph gets shoved in the pit by his brothers who are jealous of him? They shove him in a pit to die. They stop, they sit down, they eat and drink. It's a horrific scene, actually. Like, how could you be so callous? So there's a way in which food, you know, figures into every kind of moment. And it has been internalized in Judaism as this place. As I said, the rabbi said, you have become the temple. So when you have become the temple, that's a pretty big deal. And it also wove women into it, because women were the purveyors of what ended up on that table. So they became like the priestesses in the home around food. So this was an important distinction also, that men had to kind of take a back seat on that one. They may have gotten to bless it, but the women produced it. So there's a lot tied up in that. Of course, in modern times, once there was the expulsion out of the Holy Land, all of the many, many centuries in Europe of oppression and scarcity, food becomes very, very important to people. You know, it either becomes super important or like the Irish. Okay, where are the great Irish restaurants, people? Like with the great resurgence of, we're on the foodie capital of the universe, and where's the Irish? Anybody? We've got the starry plow. We've got music and we've got alcohol. Right? Not food. The Irish went, food? After those potatoes, you know, after that? No. We don't need you. We don't even want you. We don't love you. There's no Irish food culture to speak of. Really, zero. The Italians and Jews, that's everything is food. So I think it's just a way of a human response or a cultural or a group response to oppression and to difficulty. You love it or you hate it.
Hi, I would like you to say something about Shabbat.
Okay, so Shabbat is, the Jewish Sabbath. It comes in Friday night. All Jewish holidays begin at night, at sundown, and it goes through till Saturday at sundown. And, you know, Here would be my quick gloss on it, is that it's time set aside, it's kadosh, it's holy time, set aside time for us to be in a mindset of possibility, not probability. Right? It's about holding the world as it should be, not as it is. It's about going back to Gan Eden before we encountered Anne. And it's a practice. It's a very, very, very difficult practice to throw down your grief, your anxiety, your hatred, your fear, your worries about what isn't going on right, and your judgment. The biggest piece is your judgment. That was right. That was wrong. Right? I mean, Paris happened with the news hit here on Friday afternoon as we're going into Shabbat. And I'm having to tell my people, yeah, I know, but you know what? Let it go. For 24 hours, that's all. Sunday, like Saturday night, go ahead, go for it. That was wrong, those heathens, great. But for Shabbat, you just need to hold that it's all part of the whole. You need to let go of your judgment that was a good thing or a bad thing. You just need to walk into it and go, for these 25 hours, I'm going to practice equanimity. How many of us can do it? Not so much. Very difficult practice. That's why the master teachers, the master spiritual teachers teach us, if we could do it, if just the Jews, 0.24% of the world's population, 0.24% of the world's population are the Jews. If just the Jews, if just every Jew who's obligated to be in the mindset of Shabbat could do it one time, one 25-hour period, could hold in that place of it's all okay, it's all exactly the way it's supposed to be, I'm going to let go of what I think it's supposed to be and let it just be what it is and just be there for 25 hours, that the spiritual world would shift to the next phase. That's the teaching.
So thank you very much. I'm sorry. Time is up.
Thank you.